enter the room and realize no other squire is present, that I understand the nature of the ordeal. Ixion is lounging on one of the sofas across from Roxana, Rode, and a few of the lesser Haorelians. Dilo, Faemi, and Ethelo are by the fire with their bastard skyfish cousins. One of the citadel minstrels is working a violin by the edge of the room, his forehead shining with sweat. A piece of paper is being passed among the dragonborn. The reason, I realize, for the celebration. A letter bearing the whalefin seal of Basilia. I feel my attention focus on it like a beam of light. This is information for Antigone. Here, floating around this room, from hand to hand that isn't holding a glass for me to fill. Garrison, come here. I slowly approach where Ixion lounges. When I bow, Ixion seizes a fistful of my hair and pulls down. Knees, rug. A palm flat on the weaving to balance myself. I'm breathing slowly through my mouth, my face a foot away from the floor. My first thought is of Faemi and Ethelo, noticing the flame suit. He's doing this because they realized. They reported. I'm on my way to being dropped. Julia used to say you were good at two things, Griff, Ixion says. One of them was flying. Want to guess what the other was? Roxana lets out a shrill giggle. Understanding creeps in. I'd be able to guess the answer, but don't need to. Julia used to tell me herself what two things she thought I was good at, though I hadn't realized she was also telling others. And then I wish what the twins reported was the flame suit, because sometimes, when you know you're about to be humiliated, you start wishing you could just be dropped instead. How is it that even beyond the grave, Julia's able to shame me? Miss her. I was a fool to ever miss her. A dog might as well miss its owner for all it meant to her. And I've always known that. I don't need pillow talk divulged to Ixion as proof of it. I've always known what she was to me, and I to her. When I don't answer, Ixion pushes harder. My forehead touches the ground. Ixion, for the love of the dragon, Faemi says, which means Dilo's too panicked to say anything. I asked you what she said, Griff. I give him the answer, face against the rug, and then at Ixion's prompting, I say it again in my own language. I hear the Norish how they hear it, crude and obscene. Rhodes' snort cuts the air. I hate how these people have trained me to hear my own language with shame. I would have thought, Ixion goes on, that you'd mourn longer before finding another dragonborn's bed to warm. But apparently you just can't get enough. I wait, counting breaths for more. But after three, Ixion releases my hair. What are you waiting for? He says. Pour the wine. I try and fail to read Freda's letter as I pour. It exchanges hands too often. Her scrawl is so unlike the handwriting I practice reading with Antigone that I barely know what to make of it. And beyond that, I'm having enough trouble keeping my hands from shaking. Dilo sits like a frozen hare, eyes on his knees even when I pour him wine. When he rises among the first guests to retire, Roxana bids him goodnight loudly and drunkenly, and he offers a rigid bow in return. When he's gone, her laughter turns to tears. She spills wine and tells me to clean it up. It goes on for hours. Night is closer to morning, and the gulls have begun their waking cries, when Ixion and Rhode, the last of the guests to remain, at last slump unconscious from wine. Only then, as if pulled by an unseen force, do I trace numb steps to Dilo's chambers. I've barely knocked when he opens it, murmuring my name to pull me inside. Forgive us, he murmurs. Forgive me. I don't ask him for what. I don't tell him he should have said something when Ixion pressed my face into the rug. But when I kiss him hard, like I want him to feel pain. Dilo lets me break it off first, and then holds me tighter. Griff, he murmurs, his cheek against mine, and I can feel the wetness on it. Promise me, whatever you're planning, whatever happens to us in the end, don't let them hurt Feymi and Ethelo. Whatever you're planning. I could deny it. For a half breath, I think to. But truth is so precious, so rare, I want to cradle it like he cradles me. I won't. And Jephira. Jephira, his skyfish, Sparker's sparring partner. I kiss him because I don't have a promise I can make, and he chokes down a sob. He doesn't think to ask for mercy for himself. The day after Ixion's party, I make my way to Bran's and find Fiona there as well, with him. Not just in his company, but with him. His arm is around her where they sit by their small hearth, with his grandmother and mother and brothers. They rise when they see me, and Bran's arm again finds her waist, reaching down from his great height. I've got something to tell you. We've got something to tell you too, Fiona says, smiling. Let's do it outside. Bran's family lives on the edge of Clan Turret, close to the breakers. We crunch through the snow, down to the cove where the lighthouse spears the longest peninsula, and stand among the puffins under the snow-draped cliffs looking out at Turret and Nag, and, a little farther around the bend, Sleepy Knoll. Our clan castes. As children, when we were only just beginning our training, we came here together and poached the Lord's oysters and stopped caring that we came from different clans, because as squires we'd formed our own. What is it? Fiona asks. You first. Bran looks at Fiona and she nods, and he looks back at me. Fiona's with child, he says. I look at her and see a host of feelings cross her face at once as she smiles. Fear, but also pride and joy and hope. And though I can think of a dozen reasons this is not just bad news, but the worst news, I feel a smile answer hers, as if the heart of the thing has a joy that fear can't stifle. Do they know? No, Bran lets out a despairing laugh. And even if we passed it off as another's, we don't know if they'd allow one of their riders to get with child. Congratulations, I tell Fiona. She smiles at me, one hand on her waist, the other in Bran's. That smile, I think, it could break 1,000 hearts if the Dragon Lords could only see it. For a moment, I see it, the webs linking us like chains, Fiona to her child, Bran to Fiona, Bran and Fiona to their families, and me to Aga, and Aga to Becca and Garrett, and our families to one another, bound across this island and weakened because we love. But now that has to make us strong. Let the rivalries that they've used to drive our clans apart fall away before us. I from Clan Nag, Bran from Clan Turret, Fiona from Clan Knoll, and the rest of the squires from across the clans, united by the fact that we are dragon riders and Norsian. I tell them, I've been meeting with the Kalipolan First Rider. You? Says Bran, in probably the most insulting tone of disbelief possible. You sly bastard. My grin grows. How? Asks Fiona. I reach into the neck of my shirt and pull out the chain of Sparker's key. Their eyes widen. Where did you get that? Dilo. Fiona gives Bran a look not unlike the one Feymi gave Ethelo 2 nights ago. Griff and his dragonborn, she says. Fresh off Ixion's party, I'm pretty well done with hearing remarks about my proclivities. This is different. Fiona touches my shoulder. Her teasing tone drops. I know. For a second, I look out over the surf, feeling her hand on my shoulder and the memories it contains. The years of humiliation and burns and fear. No more. I cover her hand with my own. The plan, I tell them, is to poison the triarchal dragons and break the muzzles. But I understand, especially if you've got a child to worry about, if you don't want to risk that. But Bran is grinning so wide it looks painful. Are you joking? There's no risk more worth taking. Fiona nods. The squires are with you, Griff. I find Antigone Sir Aela that night with my words bursting. It's our last meeting before midwinter, and the dunes are snow-dusted. As soon as I've slid from Sparker's back, he bounds towards Aela, freezing when she begins to sniff at him with her small, smoking nostrils. I've got information for you. Your granaries, they know where they are. That's what they're planning to strike once the snows thaw. Antigone inhales, slowly. The Passy's leaflet, she says, like she's realizing something.
The what?
Nothing. Thank you. The dragons begin to circle each other, still sniffing noisily, a ritualized greeting that leaves rings of claw prints in the sand. Every time little Aela leaps at him, Sparker freezes. The perfect gentleman. The perfect gentleman who deserves to stretch his jaws at last. I blurt. I told the other squires. Antigone's eyes widen. Excitement makes my voice shake. We're ready. As soon as you can get us the poison, we'll do it. Antigone swallows and nods. I'll get you some by our next meeting, she says.
22. The Janiculum Theatre. Annie. I've never seen any evidence that Megara's stolen grain found more deserving mouths than my daily rationing supervision does. But all the same, sometimes I wonder how it must have felt. Fleeing the Lyceum with those carts, high with the thrill of having stolen to feed the poor. Lee and Cor must feel it, wandering off into the night for their secret meetings, penning articles that bravely imagine a better world. It must be satisfying the same way teaching Griff to read is, planning a rebellion to free his people, like you know who the enemy is. I can't blame the Passy for wanting it to be simple. But when Griff bears news of the map of our granaries in the hands of New Pythos, I remember that it is simple, and not the way Megara Roper thinks it is. This is what I'm thinking as Atreus Athanatos calls a meeting to address the joint summit of the Janiculum and Gold Advisory Councils, attended by a full assembly of the Inner Palace Ministry in the Palace Throne Room on Midwinter's Eve. He begins, Damocles, called by some the father of philosophy, once wrote that everyone is equally deserving. With his back to the guardians arrayed on the dais, Atreus does not see how Lee and Cor stir. His voice is barely raised, the same mild tone he uses in a small seminar class, but it carries easily through the vaulted throne room. The audience, recognizing the Passy's slogan, sits completely frozen, except for Miranda Hayne, the Minister of Propaganda. She sits in the front row, her gaze fixed unblinking on the protector and her lips a minutely moving line, as if the words of this speech are ones she knows. A noble sentiment, Atreus admits. But we must not forget the repercussions of this noble sentiment. Damocles' ideology threw the Damian Peninsula into chaos. Without strong leadership or dragons to defend them, at the whim of an easily manipulated people's assembly. They were vulnerable and divided in a time when they needed a unified front. The belief that we are all equally deserving nearly lost Deimos the Second Basileian War. Lee's shoulders are drawn ever so slightly farther back than natural. The people in this audience are here for a reason, Atreus says. They are here because they have been found through a system open to each and every citizen to be more deserving. Lee's gaze wanders from Atreus to the room around us. The rain-spattered glass that has been painted over the three stone arches behind Atreus, which in the old regime opened out onto the Firemouth to welcome the dragons of the three triarchs, the revolutionary banners draped from the vaulted ceiling, the single chair for the first protector, replacing the triple throne that I've seen in tapestries and Lee has, in all likelihood, seen in person. Lee remembers different constituents in this room. Different banners from the ceiling. Different speeches. Perhaps this is another reason why, as his gaze settles on Atreus, his lip twists. If the fact of your merit rankles compared to the egalitarian ideals of Damocles, Atreus says, and now his voice has hardness more fitting declarations of war, I remind you that so long as you serve this government and this revolution, it is the reality you live and the responsibility you bear. He holds up the Passy's leaflet, the same one Griff Garrison described on the dunes at our last meeting, the one that leaks the location of our granaries. What began as a diverting intellectual exercise has become a national security crisis. I urge anyone with information regarding the Passy or this leak not to jeopardize their country any longer. Do your duty. Across the dais, Lee's eyes meet mine. I file the report immediately after Atreus's address adjourns. Lee, Kor, Megara. Three names. Three possibilities. One chance to choose. I stare down at the report template, stomach heaving, heart racing, and tell myself the choice I make is not motivated by personal bias, but by my needs as commander of the Kallipolan aerial fleet. I submit the report to the Ministry of Information on my way to the defense wing. The performance this evening at the Janiculum Theatre will be the Guardian's last obligation before midwinter, and leave has been permitted among the higher ranks and within city limits. As I have nowhere to pack for, I spend the afternoon convincing General Holmes that Guardians should take dragons with them on leave and that the city granaries should be relocated. Holmes is reluctant at the latter request.
That's overtime work for the city guard, when they'd rather be home with their families. We already doubled the guard.
Doubled guards won't protect the granaries from airstrikes, sir. You heard the protector's speech this morning. He's worried the Passy's map got into the hands of the Pythians. Holmes's crisply trimmed beard makes it difficult to read his expression. I add, with a finger toward the window, looking out over the Firemouth, down which rainwater courses. It's raining. The snow is melting. If the warmth continues, we'll be exposed.
Antigone,
Holmes begins, and then hesitates. Since the attack on New Pythos, where he reamed me with birth-based slurs in front of my subordinates after acknowledging a mission well accomplished, he has started checking himself like this in front of me. He seems to change tack mid-sentence.
I'll see what I can do.
I leave Holmes's office
with a moderate level of satisfaction. I'm one of the last guardians of the evening to arrive in the great reception hall of the Janiculum Theatre. Decked in garlands and holly, lit by chandeliers shaped like bursts of dragonfire, its merriness has a way of catching. Even when you're waiting, a pulse throbbing in your wrists, for the moment the Ministry of Information responds to your tip-off. With a glass of mulled wine warm between my fingers, I observe the milling guests. Lee in the centre of the floor, deep in conversation with Dora Mithridates and her cadre of patricians. Cor to the side of the room, laughing over his wine with Megara Roper, who wears a gown of muted green. Power, surrounded by his usual bevy of gold girls. When he looks up at me, he doesn't look away for a long moment, and even after he does, I feel the touch of his eyes lingering as heat on my skin. Members of the Protector's Guard stand at attention at every exit, their mantles crimson as the holly berries decking the wreaths. "Hey, you!" Krissa takes my arm in hers. Discharged from the infirmary after a month of rehabilitation, she's propped on a crutch, but leans on it with all the confidence of a scepter. Her dress is shining gold, bright as her hair. I'm relieved and a little surprised at her open smile. I'm the reason her leave request to Harbortown didn't get approved for midwinter. "I'm so sorry, Krissa. We're on high alert because of the warm spell." Krissa lifts a shoulder, her smile fixed. "It's all right. I'm sure we'll all have a good time at Kor's." I don't quite manage to keep a smile up, and Krissa notices. "You're not going?" "I wasn't invited. Because it's my fault Duck is dead. Because Lee and Kor joined an illegal protest group that publishes cartoons villainizing me. Because I just filed a report that will destroy what is left of our friendship." What would she say if I explained all of it? A line goes between Chris's eyes as she looks from me to the two boys on the other side of the hall, like she's weighing something. Then she smiles at me and nods at my dress. "This colour suits you." We're in gowns on loan from the Ministry of Propaganda. I chose red. Revolutionary red. I watch her limp on, joining Kor and Megara and Lee, who has broken from Dora with a frown. Megara turns to Krissa, and Krissa smiles her classic radiant smile as introductions are made, and Megara responds to it like an opening flower. My stomach sinks. Of course, Krissa's always been Kor's and Lee's friend first, mine second. I wonder if I imagine the attention of the Protector's Guard on Megara. "Will it be your first time seeing one of the ancient tragedies performed?" Atreus, the first Protector, has joined me with one of his inscrutable smiles as the chimes begin to sound and the doors to the theatre hall open. I push away the guilt I last felt at enjoying his attention. If I'm betraying Lee by speaking to the First Protector, I betrayed him more by filing that report to the Ministry of Information this afternoon. Does Atreus know what I did? "My first time seeing any play," I tell Atreus. We move with the milling golds, who have begun to filter into the hall. "About time. For a dragon tongue scholar as fine as yourself, you will find..." Atreus steps aside at the door, allowing me to enter the hall first. "Much to appreciate about this play, I think." At the aisle, he sets a hand on my shoulder, and his voice becomes a low murmur. "Callipolis thanks you for your service."
Lee. "My dear boy," Dora Mithridates says at the reception before the Midwinter's Eve performance, "I think we may have to delay your presentation before my friends with the Gold Advisory Council. Many of them did not appreciate the Passy's latest disclosure about the granaries. With the Protector's speech this morning, we're all feeling a little more cautious. Her voice is as hard as the gleaming beads of her necklace in the light of the chandeliers. When I start to say I had nothing to do with the Passy's printing, she only looks impatient. But you're friendly with those who do, are you not? Her throaty disapprobation leaves a dull thunk in my stomach that has been wound tight ever since Atreus's address this morning in the throne room. The gall of him to stand on the dais where my uncle once stood and lecture about who is deserving. Dora gives me a pursed smile. Be careful, darling, she tells me. She glides away. Megara takes her place. Of course, she says, watching Dora join a circle of conversation with Dean Orthos, and not sounding particularly sorry. The Golds are losing interest. I round on her. Megara's dress is one of the only ones in the room that's not full length, formal, or bespoke, but it is, of course, green. How exactly am I supposed to win their favor if you're printing state secrets? Atreus is cracking down. Megara knocks back her sparkling wine and discards her palace standard accent like a shed coat. I wouldn't be so worried. There's more than one way for you to replace Atreus. It can be done with or without the Golds. Constitutionally it can't, but I have the sudden suspicion Megara doesn't feel so constrained. That wasn't what Lazari and Tyrann said originally. Megara snorts. You may not have been listening closely enough. In case you haven't noticed, people in this city are starving. We will probably need to act soon, preferably before your girlfriend catches up with us. She nods at a figure draped in flaming red on the opposite side of the room that I realize, with a double take, is Annie. She looks like a vision of fire. And she's in conversation with Atreus. About to ask what Megara means by act soon, I hear myself say, she's not my girlfriend. Atreus has the look of a concerned professor, attentive and paternal, as he leans over to hear Annie's answer to his question. The kind of look I remember craving when I didn't know he wanted me dead and lied about it. Annie responds to his attention with the warmth I remember, her smile touched, her eyes bright. Just a little starstruck, her wine forgotten in a slack hand. Are you going to talk to Atreus? I hope I don't have to. As I remember our conversation, I feel like kicking something. Cor joins my side, looking like he's been stuffed in the ceremonial uniform against his will, and his hair is protesting. Between its ill fit and the shadow of beard he neglected to shave, he looks rakish. The circle is completed by Chryssa, glittering in a golden gown that I'm careful not to study, and smiling at Megara with a question in her eyes. I don't believe we've met. Cor introduces them, half stammering. Megara Roper, Chryssa Surfedra. Lee, a word? He steers me by the shoulder away from the two girls. Behind us, Chryssa lets out a perfectly charmed laugh at something Megara says. I have a half second to wonder why Chryssa feels the need to put on a performance before Cor rounds on me. His voice is lowered to a severe whisper. I found something in Annie's saddlebag. You went through her stuff? Megara asked me to, after Atreus's address this morning. She wanted to find a way to keep Annie quiet. Lee, look. The bells are chiming, guests beginning to filter into the hall, but Cor only pulls me deeper into a shadowy arcade. He holds out a battered composition notebook that is gritty with what seems to be sand. It takes me a moment to understand what I'm looking at. The notebook is filled with Annie's handwriting in dragon tongue. For a moment, I think it's grammar exercises from our earliest school days. Then, I realize what she's been writing is names, and they're in her adult hand. another, much less mature hand has copied after her. Griff, Garrison, Aga, Garrett, Becca, Dilo Skyfish. She's been in touch with the Pythians, I realize. That's what she's been doing on those night patrols with power. Not just any Pythian, Kor says, tapping the name Griff Garrison. This is Ixion's squire, the one who held her off when Duck fell. She's been meeting with the person who helped kill Duck. Kor's voice trembles on his brother's name. It seems fishy as hell, and it makes me sick. I know Megara would say we should use this information against her as leverage if she tries to report us. But he sounds frightened, like the idea of blackmail, the idea of needing blackmail, is taking this somewhere over his head. I'm starting to feel that way too. I take the notebook from him. Let me talk to Annie. Ushers are waiting for stragglers to enter so they can close the doors. Annie and Atreus are already inside. Megara and Chrissa making their way in while still deep in conversation, their laughter airy, their arms entwined. It occurs to me that the only thing I'm less in the mood for than interrogating Annie is sitting through an ancient dragon tongue tragedy that I distinctly remember boring me as a child. Citizens, I'm afraid there's some bad news. Lotus has joined Kor's side, looking grave and pompous. Just heard it from my father and Dean Orthos. Apparently the censorship committee modified the play. From his tone, I would have expected him to tell us someone died. Kor pinches the bridge of his nose. I don't believe this. Yeah, what a tragedy, Lotus. That's the thing, says Lotus. It isn't anymore.
Annie. The dragon tongue the players use is old as in the Aurelian cycle, but their acting is emphatic, enunciated clearly from behind their masks, so what I don't understand of the language I infer from their performance. My seat is next to Lee's, in the front row, among the guardians of the Eighth Order and higher. The play is called Flamefall at Aureos. And toward the end of the first act, the chorus turns to the female lead and sings, "You have a warm heart for such chilling deeds." I touch my face and find it wet. But after that, the story changes. It's one I've read before, in translation in junior literature classes, and in the original language later. I don't remember it perfectly, but I remember that it didn't end like this. With a cheerful jingle, the neat triumph of good over evil, and a happy marriage between the two romantic leads, even the dragon tongue shifts, becomes just a little more workmanlike. Fair means each receives what they deserve, the chorus cheers. That's when I realize the play's been tampered with by the censorship committee. It ends with the line, "Lucky are they whose lives know no taste of sorrow." The applause after the curtains go down is tepid, and then, as if the audience remembers something, it turns emphatic and becomes a standing ovation. Lee and I glance at each other once before rising with the rest of the applauding hall. The players take their bows, masks lifted. As soon as they head off stage, Lee and I ease back into our seats to wait for the rows to clear. "Well, that was not how I remembered it," Lee remarks. The botched ending seems to have shaken him out of his strange mood and left him in darkly good humour. I'm straining to remember the play from studying it in class years ago. Wasn't it supposed to be that the old king turned out to be corrupt and killed her fiancé? So she killed him and then herself? Yeah, I assume that was considered too destabilizing. I can hear Mitt Hartley, chairman of the censorship committee, bragging boomingly from a few rows back about the play's modifications as he queues to exit his row. Much more what everyone's in the mood for, don't you think? The voices joining his are loudly approving. But the muttering from other clumps of golds are less enthusiastic. I spot Dean Orthos and Lo Tirin arguing heatedly in dragon tongue on the opposite aisle. The full line, Lee says, clearing his throat to make a rare switch into his mother tongue, is, "Lucky are they whose lives know no taste of sorrow, but for those whose house has been shaken by ruin, so too will that sorrow be wreaked upon their children." He hesitates on the word children, and as he does, my own memories twist like a knife point. With a sudden rush of tenderness, I reach to take his hand. That's how I find my notebook in it. The notebook in which I've been practicing dragon tongue with Griff, that would have been in my bag this morning, among my other books, in my office. Someone's been going through my things. And though I should feel anger, all I feel is relief. Now, at last, I can tell Lee everything.
Lee. Around us, the golds have risen to leave the theatre, but we remain sitting in the centre of the front row, the notebook between us. The sour taste of that tacked-on ending is slowly fading from my mouth. We're finally talking, and I didn't even have to ask. Garrison came to me that night after dark to ask my forgiveness. Annie's voice thickens as she begins to explain. And to offer to help. I've been teaching him to read so he can pass me information. That's who you've been meeting on your night patrols with Power? Yes. Talking feels good. Like exhaling after a breath held too long. Maybe if we talk long enough, we can talk about everything that's been piling up since Duck's funeral, including Megara and the Passy. Maybe I can convince her once and for all not to report anything to Atreus. Annie's eyes go up to the gilded ceiling for a moment. She grips the wooden armrest between us. Then she straightens and looks at me. The reason I've been meaning to talk to you about this is that Griff's not just passing me information. I'm helping him plan something there, too. She seems stiff saying it, as if telling me makes her nervous, even though, as far as I can tell, it would be the obvious strategy. An uprising? Annie nods. She closes her eyes and presses her thumb between them. We were thinking of using Drachthanasia. Suddenly, I understand her reticence. Annie's planning another widowing. The kind of uprising where you render your rulers helpless and then massacre them. The obvious strategy. And so typical of Annie, who is always ready to do what it takes. Ah. The relief I felt to be talking freely is fading fast. How can she speak of this to me? Surely living through one tragedy, no false happy ending to save it from horror, was enough. And now she speaks of another. The thing is, Annie says with a furtive glance in my direction, then away again at her fingers. I can't figure out where they got the Drachthanasia from. I know the Dragonborn had to distill it for generations, and all the literature refers to family caches. But I don't know where they'd be now. You were hoping I knew where to find some. Annie nods. Do you? She finally looks me in the face, and whatever she sees in my expression makes her blanch. She opens her mouth. I have a split second to wonder, with a kind of fiery dispassion, if it will be an apology, because it turns out she's right to be reticent. I do have a problem with the idea of repeating atrocities, like the widowing, on my own blood kin. when another voice shouts from the other end of the theatre, Lee! Cor is elbowing through the exiting guests, forcing his way against traffic down to where we sit. Lee, he says, white-faced. Megara's gone.
Annie. It feels good to remember I can trust Lee. To feel his hand in mine and tell him everything. It makes me wonder if even the report to the Ministry of Information will be something I can explain. Maybe it's not too late to reach an understanding, a full understanding of everything. And then I say the word, Drakthanasia, and watch his face go to that place of fury so cold, I can't reach him through the ice. The sounds around us, of Gold's leaving the theatre, grow muffled as my own voice, seeking his, strains. And then Cor skids to a halt at the aisle beside us, gripping the seat on the end of the row, and I finally hear what he's yelling. Megara's gone. I get to my feet. Dizziness takes me with such a force that I brace my arm on the chair for support, muffling others' voices and making mine loud in my own ears. They did it during the performance. She was removed. Lee gets to his feet as well. His wild grin has faded. Cor's face twists. What do you mean, removed? He snarls. It's a question that treads water, because we all know what removed means. We've all done rounds with the Ministry of Information, with the Re-Education Committee at the Vault. We know how this works. I give the unnecessary answer. Removed by the Ministry of Information, for questioning. We even know how it would have happened. Megara would have been tapped on the shoulder during the performance, led out into the foyer, quieted if she struggled, and led to a carriage that would take her to the vault discreetly, with minimal attention. Arrests of Golds are carried out most discreetly of all. Cor isn't bothering to be discreet. Those exiting the theatre have turned to watch the spectacle. I can see Chryssa, gleaming in her golden dress, observing us from the far end of the aisle, with her weight against her crutch. Power slinking our way like a mountain cat through the edge of the crowd, his eyes on me. Questioned about what? Cor demands. About the stolen grain? About the rogue printing press? On what charge? Cor shouts. I'm gripping the back of my chair so tightly my knuckles have whitened. Disturbing the peace under the name of Southside's daughter. Sedition. Dissemination of state secrets. Then charge me too, Cor shouts. Lee seems to snap to his senses. He has noticed, as I have, members of the Ministry of Information among those leaving. The Protector's Guard lining the exits. He seizes Cor and grips the side of his neck, a palm against his chin. Enough, he growls. I can't charge you, I tell Cor through the heat in my face. Though I should. I need you both. I need you for when the Pythians come, because someone gave them that map of our granaries and they're coming for them. Slack against Lee's grip, Cor's eyes widen. Yeah. That's right, Cor. That's what I've been doing with Griff Garrison. Getting information about the other side. Since you were kind enough to rifle through my bag, and I'm sure you've been wondering, I've been helping my country win a war, which is more than either of you can say for yourselves right now. I hold my notebook up. Lee releases Cor and he sags, dragging a hand across his face. A ministry messenger has broken from the crowd, approaching us looking harried, a memo in hand. Cor's staring at me wide-eyed. Lee's no longer looking at me at all. Go home, I tell them, tasting the bitterness of my words, and enjoy your midwinter. I watch their retreating backs with burning eyes. At the back of the hall, Krissa joins them. They leave the theatre together, leaving me feeling suddenly, terribly alone. I have to read the memo pressed into my hand twice before I understand it. Power joins my side to find me laughing. I specified on the report that I would like to interrogate Megara myself. It was the only way I could conceive of sparing her the harsher methods she would be left to in the vault. I'm approved to interrogate Megara, I tell him, as the laughter turns to something else. Tomorrow. Midwinter day. Because the ministry noted that I didn't request leave. For some reason, this, of all things, is what makes me feel like crumpling. Power takes the memo from me with uncharacteristic gentleness. Before that, he says, you're coming to my house for Midwinter.
23. The Sky Widower. Griff. On Midwinter's Eve, I seal and deliver a reply from Ixion to the last trade ship out of port before the feast day. His handwriting is easier to make out than that of the letter that made rounds at his party. And without the pressure of reading it through fury or shame, I'm able to decipher it in its entirety as I fold it. My dearest Princess Freyda, I am overjoyed that you also see an alignment of our interests. We will offer pressure, and you relief. But first, the catalyst. Shall we meet in person to discuss? Yours ever in armor and with ardor, Ixion Sir Neter Stormscourge, son of Crethan, Triarch Presumptive of Callipolis the West. My next scheduled visit with Antigone is in a week's time, the day after New Year's. With all luck, she'll hear of this letter before it even reaches Vask, because I'm pretty sure she'll find it interesting. I finish up the afternoon in the lairs. I'll be serving at the feast tonight, and with any luck, I'll be able to bring home a few treats from the feast for the little ones. And then tomorrow we'll make the solstice pilgrimage across the water and up the winding stairs along the Nag's Mane to her shrine. It's a pleasant enough prospect that even shoveling Neter's dung is more tolerable than usual. A clatter of stone in the corridor outside makes me straighten, sweat dripping down my back. The Haorellians are paranoid after the drying up of the old line of dragons, so the lairs are kept a furnace in winter to help the fleet through it. I'm expecting Ixion, or maybe, if I'm very lucky, a midwinter gift from the shrines, Dilo. But it's Faemy, Dilo's sister. Her hair is braided for the feast, but she's not yet in a formal gown, and when she sees me, she grinds to a halt, clutching her side. Griff, thank the dragon. I was hoping you'd be down here. Are you all right, my lady? I'm fine. It's just... Father... My stomach sinks. I've nothing against Faemy, even if I wish she and Ethelo hadn't gossiped to Roxana. She wasn't one of the ones who laughed at that party when Ixion shoved my face into the rug. She's tolerable. But Nestor's a different matter. He hates the Humble Riders almost as much as Ixion, though his methods for making our lives difficult are of the subtler variety. The you learn or you burn variety. Which was pretty exciting while the squires were still shaky on our dragon tongue. Why would I be needed for Nestor? I'm not yet done in the lairs, my lady. Griff, please, I don't want anyone else to see. I drop the cart and follow her, wondering without much optimism whether please means she'll bother explaining to Scully where I went, whether I'll have to return to finish up in the lairs after the feast, whether my wages will be docked for my absence. But Faemy's young, thoughtless but not malicious, and in any case, I'll admit I'm a little curious about Nestor. Your humble servant is honoured to be so trusted by Lady Faemy, I announce as we make our way up the spiral stone stairs. Faemy lifts her nose in the air. I don't trust you. I trust my brother. I'm surprised by how touched I am that she's insulting me by way of him. She rounds on me at the top of the stairs and pokes a manicured finger into my chest. And while we speak of it, I'll burn you to a crisp if you ever hurt him. Still more touched, I bow low. She gives me a look of disdain that could melt glass. We enter the Skyfish Armory, and I finally understand. The room stinks of alcohol. Nestor, badly drunk, is slouched in a corner, glaring at us cross-eyed. A half-empty bottle of Basilean whiskey and a battered suit of what I can only guess is his own pre-revolutionary armor on the table beside him. I've heard D'Lo mention, but never seen, his father suffering a sorrow spell.
"Where's D'Lo?" Nestor demands.
"I'm getting him, father." Nestor and Feimy are both speaking unnaturally loudly, as if to drown out something else. She turns to me and lowers her voice. "Stay with him while I look. Shouldn't you stay with him?"
"No,"
Nestor says, pointing at me.
"He stays."
"Grand." Feimy mouths, "Thank you," and hurries from the room.
"Sit,"
Nestor says. He sits at a work table usually reserved for squires maintaining the Dragonlord's armor. On the instinct, years in the making, against ever being caught idle in front of Nestor, I reach for the polish and a rag. The old armor does need polishing. Looks like no one's done it properly since the revolution. I slide his breastplate gingerly toward me and begin to work it.
"She didn't like boats," Nestor says.
My polishing freezes as I realize who this must be, because D'Lo's mentioned the boats before too. D'Lo's mother didn't like boats. This is why, when the Skyfish Summer Palace was overrun and the minor Dragonlord and his children missed the purge on a fishing trip in the Medean, she did not escape it with them.
"Fishing trip? Come along. No, boats aren't to my taste. You know me. Who marries a skyfish when you don't like boats? Alana loved midwinter."
Nestor takes the bottle by its neck and gulps the contents like water. I consider whether my duties here include physically preventing him from consuming more alcohol. It doesn't seem worth the potential beating for laying a hand on a dragonborn. And even drunk, Nestor's dead weight would be considerable in a match of strength.
"I could feel it," he says, "when I lost her."
"Your wife?" Tears spill down Nestor's cheeks.
"My dragon."
The sweat trickling down my back feels suddenly cold.
"Just an emptiness."
Nestor gestures to the back of his head, as if he'd felt the emptiness in his skull.
"And then I knew I'd lost Alana as well. Lost everything."
Panic is rising sweet and acrid as the resonances hit me. All that I'm planning with Antigone. All that I confessed to Bran and Fiona. D'Lo. Sweet D'Lo. I can't do this to D'Lo. I croak, "Not everything, my lord." Nestor's vacant gaze fixes on me, sitting across from him, working over his rusted cuirass with unseeing fingers. Between who I am and what I'm doing and what I've said, he seems to recognize me for the first time.
"You," he rasps.
Because he's drunk and we're alone in the room and I'm nearly certain he won't remember it, I look him in the eye.
"Me."
Nestor only blinks. Then he leans forward, blearily holding my gaze.
"You make him soft."
"I...
what?"
But my hammering heart tells me what.
"Soft like his mother. Too soft a heart. Weak."
"He's not weak." Nestor stares at me. For a second, I think, of all the stupid ways to earn a beating, contradicting a drunk dragon lord. Then, to my complete surprise, he grunts agreement.
No, not weak.
Father? I jump, hard. Delos entered the armory, Feymi behind him. He turns back to her and murmurs, "Go," with a hand on her shoulder, gently steering her from the room, as if to shield her from something indecent. Then turns back to us, and I realize he isn't able to look at me. I jolt to my feet. This is an intrusion, a part of Delos' life he's kept private from me even after sharing his bed. It can't be an accident that for years I've hated Nestor, but never been given reason to pity him. Dilo doesn't want his father exposed in this state of indignity. I'll just be going. But Nestor seizes me by the arm, preventing my retreat. With the other, he fumbles for the window latch.
"Feel this breeze," he tells us.
Dilo assists him in opening the window, his lips tight, his back turned to me.
"Balmy," Nestor says. "Sparking weather."
"Yes, father."
"Tomorrow,"
Nestor tells Dilo, still clutching my arm.
"We do it tomorrow."
Dilo turns to his father and, with resignation, braces an arm around him. He removes the bottle from the table.
"Tomorrow's midwinter, father."
Nestor tosses aside my arm to take Dilo's face in both his hands, drawing it down to him.
"Exactly," he whispers, like he's confiding a secret. "That is why it is the perfect time to strike."
His eyes gleam. Dilo looks into them and sags. He lets out a cry of frustration.
"Father, do you not think we go too far? Would it not be better just to rest?"
Nestor jabs a finger down at his old armor, shaking his head.
"No! We're so close!
It's a mad dream, father. It's the only thing we have left."
Nestor kisses Dilo's forehead, and Dilo closes his eyes, his face contorting and his shoulders shuddering. I think it's the first time I've ever seen Nestor show Dilo affection. I back away, bowing as I go, though neither notices, while Dilo turns from me to hold his father, and I don't breathe until I'm out the door and have closed it after me. Feymi stands in the hallway, her shoulders up around her ears, listening. She looks ready to cry, and for a moment I consider laying a hand on her shoulder to comfort her. Then she says,
"I don't want to do an airstrike on midwinter."
It sounds like she's pouting about an ugly dress, not the prospect of bombarding unsuspecting souls on a family feast day. My pity for the lot of them evaporates.
"Callipolis will want it even less than you."
24. Megara Roper. Annie. I wake on midwinter morning in a room that isn't my own, filled with blinding light. White sheets over a wide mattress. A white canopy overhead. Sunlight streaming through white curtains. The only colour comes from a sprig of midwinter holly on the mantel, and a painting that fills the wall opposite the bed, of a pair of skyfish crossing the open sea. Gifted in gratitude to the Hesperides family by the Triarchy under Arcturus, a small gold plate reads in dragon tongue. Slowly I remember how I got here. The play, Megara's arrest, and Lee and Kor and Krissa leaving for their holiday while I stood frozen. The fit of despair and loneliness that led me to say yes without a second thought to Power's invitation to go home to the house of the boy who bullied me daily through my childhood. I'm in Power's house, and Ayla is with Eta in Power's garden. And it's midwinter day, which means I'm scheduled to interrogate Megara Roper in the vault this afternoon, I reach for my ground uniform, which I left folded on the bedside table, and pull it on. I run into Power on his way to the washroom, still in his underlayers, his face rumpled. I've grown up seeing the Corps in stages of undress, fresh from sleep. There's no excuse for the scalding blush that spreads under the neck of my uniform at the encounter.
How do you sleep, Commander? He asks, yawning.
I found my bedroom door bolted from the inside when I reached to open it this morning. Apparently, last night, I took precautions that I don't remember. But now, at his question, I realize the stranger fact. I slept well. For the first time in weeks, I didn't dream about Duck ending up on a different list. I didn't dream, as far as I can remember, about anything. We find Power's parents downstairs in the sunroom, overlooking a bright garden, sipping coffee and exchanging newspapers in front of more food than I've seen on a single table in months. I can only imagine the number of ration cards it would have taken to provide it. Bacon and eggs, biscuits and pastries, berries and clotted cream. Suddenly, I can taste my own saliva.
Hungry, dears?
I'm preparing myself to do the thing I know I'll need to do. Eat slowly, respectably. When Power begins to scarf. It's the first time I've ever noticed that he eats the way I do. Like he has trouble seeing anything but his plate. So, I start scarfing too. Neither of us speaks until our plates are clean. When I finally look up, I find Mr. Hesperides reading the Gold Gazette with great absorption. Mrs. Hesperides pats Power on the arm.
Good to have you back, Parry, darling, and so nice to have you too, Annie.
I smile back at her and start to wonder and can't stop. What would it have been like to end up here instead of in an orphanage? With rooms so full of luxury, even your bare feet feel comforted by soft carpets, with food in abundance, and most of all, with love. To wake from nightmares to someone like Mrs. Hesperides to comfort you. It would have made all the difference in the world. For the next 2 hours, I feel as though I'm living in a dream outside of time. Somewhere beyond this house, these great frosted windows and high ceilings, my life awaits me. My duties as a guardian, as a first rider, to find Megara Roper in the vault, and face Lee and Kor afterward, to move the granaries and prepare for attack. But for now, I can wander through this other life, trailing my fingers along it like the keys of an open piano. Power shows me around the estate after breakfast, burping from satisfaction. We visit the dragons, wreaking havoc in the garden and frolicking in the fair weather while the Hesperides' gardener fumes on the edge of the lawn. We mount the grand staircase, and several narrower ones after that, to reach the suite of rooms Power claims as his own at the top of his house.
My lair, used chiefly these days for the seduction of women.
I fold my arms. Power rolls his eyes with a shrug and unlatches the door to his balcony.
Or not.
I leave a good 3 feet between us on the railing, unsettled by how I've reddened. We can see the whole city from his balcony. It's warm enough to stand comfortably in the breeze with only my ground uniform. Power shivers just a little in his undershirt. It's late morning. The sky grey with low stratus, obscuring the top of Pytho's Keep and leaving the Janiculum in shadow. I summon up the courage to ask, "How old were you when..." Power's gaze is locked on the horizon.
"About 3.
And before it?"
"Don't remember."
A little too quick. A little too pat. Like this is a wall not just for me, but for himself. I know from an older conversation that his mother, a housekeeper for the Hesperides family, passed away in a poorhouse, and he never knew his father. Whatever his situation was before this, he was hungry. Still, when I think of a childhood waking up to Mrs. Hesperides piling food on your plate, I can only think of power as lucky. Below us, the city, smoking and steaming and gleaming from the evaporating rain, sits quiet and still for midwinter. Power lifts a finger and points. Toward the far edge of the city, the great square rooftops of the manufacturing district, where the vault imprisoning Megara Roper lies. Soon it will be time to interrogate Southside's daughter.
So, did the Ministry give you guidelines?
Power asks. They made clear what they wanted. Power offers a feral grin.
At least you'll be doing it on a full stomach.
Lee. We're in the palace courtyard. And Argus Aurelian, 12 years old, is doubled over, vomiting. He is asking for his father. He is asking for his dragon. He says, I can't feel her. My brother, Laertes, says, go, get help. The soldiers who are supposed to help laugh instead. I wake midwinter morning with a jolt. I'm in the boys' room of the Sutter House, under a patchwork quilt, not quite long enough to cover my toes. On a top bunk level, with a window overlooking city rooftops. I lie back, stare up at the cobwebs dangling from the ceiling, and remember what happened last night. The leftover nausea of the nightmare mixes with aftershocks of fury with Annie. At her plea for help with planning another widowing, as if she wasn't asking for my help with an atrocity. At the way she calmly confessed to reporting Megara. I feel guilt approaching horror that something the Passy printed is now a map in enemy hands. That wasn't what I joined sides with Megara for. But the fact is, airstrikes have been a risk since the war began. A friend captured and facing torture at the hands of the government I work for is new. Overhead, the roof creaks, a dragon shifting. We were ordered to take them with us on leave because of the city's high alert. They're nesting on the Sutter roof. Kor's asleep on the bed across from mine, his younger brother Greg curled beside him.